I think now the challenge for cybersecurity folks is to meet that challenge and think about how we enable those outcomes, right? For a long time, CISOs and cybersecurity folks were the cyberist people there were, right? They were the folks who knew the most about the firewalls. Cybersecurity leaders nowadays need to be business leaders, they need to be business enablers, or mission leaders in this case. And so I think that's a big change now. I think cybersecurity's got to rise to that challenge. I think we're used to talking about risks, but not talking about opportunities. And that's a real change.
This is All Quiet on the Second Front, a podcast where boring conversations around defense tech and national security come to die. Join me, Tyler Sweat, and my Second Front comrades as we dismantle the mundane, cut through the bureaucratic BS to demystify the world of defense tech. But be warned, this is not a typical government podcast. Ready to get weird? This is a Soulfire production.
Welcome to All Quiet on the Second Front. I'm Donnie Azeltine, Second Front's Vice President for Security, filling in for Tyler today to talk with Matt Connor. Matt's had an amazing career in information security with major government contractors, duty agencies, and as well in the private sector. He's currently one of our board members and someone I really rely on when I talk about how we push the boundaries of security and compliance to get our software to the warfighter. I'm really excited to host him, so let's go ahead and get started. Matt, welcome to All Quiet on the Second Front. Maybe start by introducing yourself and giving a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thanks, Donnie. It's great to be here. So I've been involved in cybersecurity by many names since probably the late 90s. My first job that didn't involve a hairnet or a name tag was at Cape Canaveral Air Station. And I had the opportunity then to do a little work of what we called information security at the time, CompuSec, InfoSec. Ever since then, I've had an opportunity to progress in my career, security engineering roles, technical leadership, ultimately CISO at NGA, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, then to support the DNI directly before I left for industry. I did have a kind of a burning bush moment in cybersecurity, if you'll forgive me a quick story.
Eric, go ahead.
We were on a support contract at the Cape, and we were locked out of a Windows 95 workstation at the time that was password protected. And, you know, I didn't know any better. I'd been a technologist or amateur technologist at home with computers, but I didn't know how to do anything hacking. And the security engineer named Alan Zimmerman, so Alan, if you're out there, props to you. Alan wrote a little script that used the batch file and initialization features of injected auto-run CDs to hack into the box right in front of me. And I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And I swear to you, that was like, I want to do cybersecurity. I want to do computer security because that dude is awesome. So I've been chasing that feeling ever since in cybersecurity.
Yeah, I love that. It's great when I'm talking to either service members transitioning or other folks trying to break into the cybersecurity industry, because a lot of what I always bring up is like, you've got to find that curiosity and that passion and really pull the string on that, right? So I love hearing the story of like, what was that spark that really kind of took you down this road? So when you talk about that road, I mean, you started there like, oh my God, he just hacked the box, right? And then you've gone on and now gone up through a wide range of FSEC roles on up to the highest level of, as a CISO. Can you talk maybe a little about that progression? I mean, if you look at your background on LinkedIn, it's like somewhat of a natural progression, but I know there's a lot of kind of weird turns that happens in InfoSec. So kind of how did you get from point A to point B? Was CISO always in the cards, or was it just something that kind of evolved along the way?
Yeah, it was a little more organic than you might think. I mean, I think that one hallmark was definitely that curiosity, right? I have another clear memory of following somebody down a hallway, asking him to explain the concept of ports to me. And I wanted to learn. I was so hungry for more knowledge. And I think that's really served me well throughout my career. I mean, I like a lot of us, I built a home lab at one point, and I was doing attack and defend on home workstations, trying to practice my skills. So really, I think curiosity, hunger was always a key part of my journey. I was the first to volunteer for anything, even if it wasn't necessarily sexy. So I remember early on getting a chance to do some software inventory, a thankless position, really, because it was just counting software licenses and stuff. But it was giving me that understanding of how we associate authorization, how we associate approval with certain systems and those kinds of things. And I just kept building on that. I was very fortunate early on to have leaders who supported me, who were willing to invest in me. I did a learning tree coupon pack where I got to go to six classes at Learning Tree and get some of those fundamentals underneath me. I had people willing to let me shoulder surf as I was watching what they were doing. I got a chance to work on a commercial cybersecurity team in about 1999, 2000. Company at the time was called Trident Data Systems, but they were engaging not just on traditional defense partners, but engaging banks and hospitals and universities and paper companies and spice companies, doing security posture assessments and those kinds of things. And I think more than anything, willingness was what they saw in me, was willing to put in the work, willing to chase the skills. So I got that opportunity, and I was just off. I was bleeding cyber at the time. I was just living it. You know, it was all the newsletters, all the cons, all the everything, the home network, the whole thing. I eventually joined up with the technical security team supporting the National Reconnaissance Office at NRO. And there I got a chance to work with leaders who would later go on to lead the cybersecurity program at NGA. And so when that leader who I'd partnered with in multiple circumstances was looking for a deputy, he reached out to me and a handful of other folks at NRO and said, look, I need somebody to support me as a deputy here at NGA. And it took 10 months, but I was ultimately selected to go down there. The real sort of, you know, one of those weird turns that happens is he actually left that agency before I got there. And so my first day down at NGA, I was the acting CISO. And so that was quite a leap to go from, you know, General Dynamics senior technical leadership into the CISO role there. But there's no substitute for trial by fire. There's no substitute for that type of baptism. I had the absolute career privilege of supporting Sue Gordon when she was the deputy director for NGA. Spent a lot of time at her knee that summer, learning from her, working with her as we were talking about cybersecurity program, those kinds of things. And then a handful of years later, when the opportunity to kind of fleet up and head to the DNI to support the intelligence community in that CISO role, honestly, at first I didn't want it because I knew that was further away from real cybersecurity operations and more into strategy and politics. But the promise of doing good on a grand scale was too attractive, and I did make that leap over to IC CISO before heading off to Westinghouse.
I really like that. And I think that, you know, when you talk about volunteering for the thankless jobs, it also reminds me of like Cliff Stoll and the Cuckoo's Egg, who gets assigned this really miserable job of bean counting the compute that is being charged out, and he sees something odd, and he pulls a string, and he uncovers this massive hacking conspiracy, right? And I think also what's great about what you said is kind of the importance of mentors, right? Finding that right mentor. So when you talk about, if you look at your career and stepping in that CISO role, that may not have happened the way it did if that mentor hadn't kind of reached out and said, hey, I need a deputy, I need someone to help me here. And then your work with Sue and so on and so forth. So I think that's really critical, is just not only pulling that curiosity, volunteer for things, and also find the mentor and see where it leads. If you think back in your early days at the Cape or in the CompuSec time, how do you think like roles of the CISO has changed? Obviously, CISO didn't really exist kind of at that time as we think about it now. So when you think about like the senior leader of security, how's that changed from 20 years ago to today?
Well, I think for a long time, cyber happened over there, right? Whatever over there was, it happened in the corner. It happened in the IT organization. Maybe it happened adjacent to corporate security. I mean, I was involved in early programs there, DSCID 116, NISPOM kind of programs where CompuSec, InfoSec was under the guards, gates, and guns type of security. It wasn't viewed as its own discipline. It wasn't viewed as a critical function, right? It was kind of a black art, and there was a little bit of a priesthood off doing cyber in the corner. You know, as time has marched on, you contrast that with today, where cybersecurity is literally, you know, front page news and a board topic, right? You look at compare and contrast with where we are with SEC's rules about disclosures and material breaches. You look at CISOs now being personally liable for cybersecurity outcomes. And I think what's changed over time is that leadership, executive leadership of organizations, of agencies, of companies, of programs have recognized cybersecurity as a team sport. The CISO cannot cyber all the things by themselves. They require partners, and those partners are, you know, the legal folks and the privacy folks and the data folks and the corporate security folks. But cybersecurity outcomes are shared. And I see that changing. I see it change over time. I saw it change in the agencies and the organizations in which I worked. I saw it change in the companies that I worked. I think it's tremendous. I think it's long overdue. I think now the challenge for cybersecurity folks is to meet that challenge And think about how we enable those outcomes, right? For a long time, CISOs and cybersecurity folks were the cyberist people there were, right? They were the folks who knew the most about the firewalls, or folks who knew the most about, MITRE ATT&CK framework or something like that. Cybersecurity leaders nowadays need to be business leaders. They need to be business enablers or mission leaders in this case. And so I think that's a big change now. I think cybersecurity has got to rise to that challenge. I think we're used to talking about risks, but not talking about opportunities. And that's a real change. That's something that I'm still working on. I know that, and I know that I'll be continuing to work on that the rest of my career. So that's the real trick, I think, is cybersecurity needs to move from the back office to the front office to the board.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think that a lot of times, you know, when teams start looking at cybersecurity, you're right. There was a time where it was just pushed off to the corner where, I mean, Royal Hansen was an advisor to a program I was in, and he brought up the whole point of like, hey, look, it is a business-wide issue right now, and it is an absolute team sport. I think a lot of times when we get into that, we start getting too far down the weeds of either like geeking out on the security, which is fun to kind of that fighting aspect of it, or we get sucked into the compliance of the box checking. But I like what you brought up about thinking, stepping back and thinking the business, because I think security, it's usually a cost center. It's usually hard to kind of like wrap your head around and fit in and make sure you're budgeting for it. But there's a way security can be a business enabler. And, you know, I'd love to think a little more of that, because obviously being in government, government looks very more heavily at the compliance piece about protecting the network and locking things down. When you're into the contracting, it could go a lot of different ways. But on the private sector, the bottom line is what counts. So when you compare and contrast those experiences between working at General Dynamics or working at NGA or working at Westinghouse, like how do you take that lessons in those different roles? What are the kind of similarities and differences? But also like, how do we make security a business enabler? One that people like want to be on the team, because if you're never invited to the team, it's really hard to make that team sport work.
Yeah, there's so much there. I really like what's probably an apocryphal story. There's a, you know, story of President Kennedy touring one of the space centers at NASA, sees a janitor, asks the janitor, what are you doing? And the janitor says, I'm putting a man on the moon, right? I hate that story's probably not true, but I love how illustrative it is. Cybersecurity's job is to make widgets, right? And if our job is, if we're a national geospatial intelligence agency and our products are geospatial products to support decision makers and warfighters, cybersecurity's job, make no mistake, is to produce geospatial products to support decision makers and warfighters. When I was at General Dynamics, you know, cybersecurity's job is to support our customers delivering technical services and solutions for, you know, national security priorities, those kinds of things. At Westinghouse, my job was to enable us to deliver nuclear power to owners and operators around the world. I think that starts with a mindset is that's important. And, you know, tone starts at the top. As a cybersecurity leader, I needed to make sure our programs understood, make no mistake, your job is supporting people in camouflage. Your job is to get the intelligence out. It is not to serve a process. It is not to support your board. It is not to be a control gate. It is not to weigh paper. It is not to assess the shine on the laptops. Our job is to deliver intelligence. Our job is to provide defense. Our job is to enable warfighters. The big contrast, my experience between industry and government, you know, if you kind of break it down like a people, process, technology kind of thing, the government's answer to a lot of things is let's throw people at it. I have to think about some of the programs that I led in the government time and standing armies really of people, tremendous talent that, you know, industry brings, oftentimes timely expertise that the government has trouble recruiting or retaining. But nonetheless, you know, I had, you know, hundreds of people in some cases working on cybersecurity missions that, you know, in industry, you might have a team of 25 or something like that. I think it pushes incentives and it pushes motivations in different ways. Industry is by definition, I believe, incentivized to look for efficiencies, automation, and scalability. The government doesn't directly think like that, right? Without that profit motive, the government, far more deliberate in my experience. And so, you know, I mean, think about the people thing. I think the size of the army that you can bring to bear in the fight is going to be markedly different. The type of talent you can recruit and retain is going to be different. The speed and agility of recruiting and retaining that talent is striking. I know when I left the intelligence community, The target for getting someone on board was 6 months, and that's down from almost 500 days sort of the norm there for bringing folks in. Industry can't wait. It moves much quicker than that. So market differences in the people. The government, process security, right? We call it paper tiger. We call it paper security. We called it, pejoratively, we called it the clipboard army. So much of government processes is about workflow. It's about making sure the right discrete body evidence is submitted, left-hand justified 12-point Arial font, rendered as a PDF and uploaded into Exacta. Whether or not that actually correlates to some objective measure of cybersecurity is an open question. And then technology, the technology differences between government and industry, obviously it's the same fundamental technology, but the speed and agility that which industry can bring technology to bear on its challenges is just night and day. And you think about some of the challenges the government faced over the last handful of years and realize that as a result of budgeting processes and appropriation processes, it might take years to apply technology solutions to challenges that are manifestly obvious now. And that's tough. You can pull some knobs or pull some levers and turn some knobs in terms of year of execution, but really sort of making strategic or tactical investments in technology, the government struggles to move like that. And so it's about as different as it can be, even though we're all after the same challenge, defending our critical assets from attack.
Yeah, I love the aspect of talking about the speed and agility that you see on the private sector vice the government side. And that's not a slight on the governments, right? They have different incentive structure. And I think that's important to realize. When you were at the CISO at NGA, NGA did a fabulous job of pioneering really what some things that Second Front Platform One do now, this whole ATO in a day process. How do you take the speed and agility that commercial software offers, and how do you get it through the security and compliance bottleneck to get it actually live on a government system? Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that evolved and how that evolved in the bureaucracy of the government, where we were trying to bring that speed and agility in, right?
Yeah. So, thank you. Yeah, that's a great flashback. I joined NGA just as ATO in a day was great gaining traction, and credit where credit is due. Jason Hess and Paul Puckett, specifically a friend of Second Front, had a lot to do with that. I had the privilege of kind of being the mouth of cybersecurity at that time, where, folks like Jason and Paul were the brains and the arms. I think of ATO in a day, and I think about obviously a pithy and very clever marketing phrase, but really I kind of think of it as cry from help. It was a cry for help from program managers, mission owners, resource managers saying it takes too long to do what we need to do, right? There are people in camouflage counting on this system to get home tonight. It shouldn't take me 18 months to get a stamp on it so I can turn it on. And so really ATO in a day was a response to that. It was, we can adopt lessons learned from industry, modern software development practices. We can take advantage of the promise of the risk management framework that has always been there, but was never really capitalized on, to tailor systems, to tune and allocate controls and requirements appropriately so that we can focus on the code, the application code that makes an application what it is, right? I used to use the analogy of an iPod or an iPhone, right? So Apple offers this foundation, this platform. They're going to handle authentication. They're going to handle backend storage. They're going to handle communications via onboard radios, those kinds of things. All you got to do is focus on the application code that makes you special, whether it's your Airbnb code or your Farmville code or whatever. And done correctly, you can focus on what makes your application discreetly unique, and the undifferentiated heavy lifting can be demonstrated by others. And so if you look at ATO in a day, which was all built on platform and all based on control allocation, and all based on common control provider inheritance, understanding of that flow, right? That was the promise of, let's not spend a ton of time looking at the IDAM solution that we've already looked at 50 times. Let's not spend a ton of time thinking about the transmission security stuff that we already know cold through bulk encryption and long-haul communications, those kinds of things. Let's focus on this application that's going to put this piece of intelligence in the hand of a warfighter. I know we were victims of our own success in terms of the marketing term ATO in a day. We definitely accelerated the hype cycle. But even knowing that, even when we were doing it knowing it, I thought it was important to continue to carry that message because, by God, that's the target we should be shooting for, right?
Absolutely.
The promise of that that immediate, near-term, you know, near real-time software delivery, continuous ATO based on continuous monitoring based on actual telemetry from our systems and not a three-year revisit of the ATO package. You know, that feels about right. You know, that was the promise of ATO in a day. And, you know, the early events, ATO in a day events were carefully scripted. They took months in the making, but, you know, there were some early successes there in product management partnership with mission owners, because they were prioritizing, these are the capabilities that I need to go before those. These are the features that I'm trying to roll out right now. So there's a lot of learning done on those early ATO in a day events and those early pipelines. It's a shame we weren't able to take it further. I know programs like Kessel Run and Platform One, and then, you know, what attracted me to Second Front and Game Warden was, you guys are doing it for real. This is what we were always after, right? This was, you know, we used to joke on the inside of NGA, right? People don't see that there's a million lines of code behind the easy button, and everybody wants an easy button. Of course they do. Second Front is bringing that. And so when I started talking to Tyler, I started talking to the team about what you guys were doing. Like, this is where we were going before we stopped. This is amazing. I was so excited to support this team.
Yeah, I like how you said that, you know, we think about that whole ATO day, which is a great bumper sticker for sure, but it's really a symbol of a cry for help. And I think that's important to realize. Anytime we see like significant innovation breakthroughs, especially with large bureaucracies and government, it's usually because someone down there at the warfighter level is screaming so loud, someone is finally forced to do something. Sometimes it's forced from Congress or other things, but it is something that drives it forward. You know, we had Marina Nitz on with Tyler not too long ago, and Nick Sonny as well from Hack Your Bureaucracy. And one of the things they both brought up, which I thought was interesting, is we think a lot of times as like rebelling against the bureaucracy, vice really a revolution, because you don't want to destroy the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is going to keep those good ideas in place long after you're gone. But, you know, from Marina's standpoint, it was, you can't just make a change. You've got to have the training patterns down. You've got to have the policy, the practice, the legislation behind that. And for Nick's point of being in the White House, writing an executive order looks great. But if you haven't gotten the buy-in from everyone around you, everyone's going to slow roll that, right? So maybe taking a look at where it started from and kind of where it's at now, like, what are the current challenges with modern adoption of software in the DoD? Like, we're certainly not there yet, but how far have we come, and what's next on that horizon?
Well, I mean, that's a good reminder to, you know, stop and pause and reflect how far we've come, right? I mean, we really are in a modern era of software delivery. I think the challenges, you know, we've endured over the past handful of years, I think there's still too few people involved in the cybersecurity aspects who understand modern software development practices and modern software, you know, product management lifecycle. So I think there's still a lot of spiral bound desk references of NIST 853 Rev 5, right? And that's not necessarily a terrible thing to understand the governance and the policies that underpin those things. But I still think we're really challenged by people who look for answers, you know, not in what I can measure and observe about the system, what I can understand about the workflow, what I can understand about the users, what I can understand about the solutions, but in the paper. So I think that's always going to be a challenge. You know, I once spoke with then CIO of an agency, I'll protect the innocent / guilty by not disclosing who lamented some of the challenges of delivering software at speed, that said, you know, I've got a building full of GS-15s who believe that if they don't have their board and they don't have their chair, they're not doing their job. That paints everybody with a broad brush, and that's not fair. There are tons of people trying to do the next right thing. But I do think that we look too much at process still, and not enough at the software, not enough at the solutions to really guide us towards making those authorization decisions. You know, if we're ultimately, as authorizing officials, if we're ultimately charged with deciding this is secure enough, fit for purpose, you know, to issue a cert to field or an authorization decision, there's still not enough focus on telemetry and data. There's still too much focus on paper, written bodies of evidence, judgment, subjectivity. I think we've still got a lot to go in driving out those kinds of things and driving more towards objective, near real-time velocity.
That makes a lot of sense. When we step back, I mean, there's always a means to the end. You talked a lot about mission and the reason why we do this. So just because we're accelerating software into the DoD or into the government, there's a reason for that, right? And I think that a lot of the stuff that's come out recently, really from the CSIS paper that Nan Mulchandani, who was the CTO at the CIA, and Jack Shanahan, when he had the Jake, wrote about software-defined warfare. And obviously the DoD wants software because it helps speed decision-making, it helps speed execution. So in your thoughts, looking in and having been in this problem for a while, how do you think this concept of software-defined warfare is going to change modern battlefields? And really, how are we going to adapt to be able to give our warfighters what they need?
I like the fact you said modern battlefields and not battlefields of the future, right? Because I think we're there now, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, every single weapon system is a technology platform, whether we recognize it as such or not. I forget the exact quote, but it might have been about Tesla, but it's like a technology platform that gets you where you want to go. Every weapon system is a technology platform. Every organization is a data organization, whether or not they realize it. And so, you know, if you think about success in future conflicts, the successful forces are going to be those that can adapt agilely, quickly pivot, bring to bear new capabilities, whether that's on a weapons system or in actual cyberspace effects, right? I mean, cyberspace at this point is another warfighting domain. And given the kind of asymmetry of modern conflicts, I think you're going to see more and more where kinetic operations are tied to cyber operations to ensure superiority. I know that, you know, when I was in government and we were looking at developing operating plans for various scenarios, those kinds of things, cyber and kinetic were hand in hand. If you look now at how DoD manages its mission relevant terrain for cyber, it's a readiness and lethality assessment at this point, right? How capable are we in the cyberspace dimension? Do we understand our boundaries? Do we understand our posture? Will the technology be where it needs to be to support troop movement, air superiority, maritime operations? You know, pick your outcome, but each of these things is completely pivots on technology. When you think about, you know, some of the weapon systems that are out there now and the age of the technology platforms that are underneath there, it's a pretty easy leap to assessing the fragility of those platforms. And, you know, I personally would be extremely scared if I'm still sending, 3.5-inch floppies to West weapon systems out there in order to upload software. But the reality is that's where we live. And so when the DoD can pivot really quickly, deliver software at the speed of mission, not at the speed of process, that's when I think we ensure America's superiority.
Yeah, I loved how you finished that, speed of mission and not process. And I think that's a great way to kind of close out as we finish things here. This is a great conversation, Matt. I mean, all the way from talking about the importance of curiosity, volunteer and see where it leads, get a mentor to take you on. Understand that you're not alone. Cyber is a team sport. And the importance of, like, just your focus on the mission. Cybersecurity's mission is the business or the organization's mission, not some separate piece out there. And when you start putting that mentality of mission to that level, then you can get at that speed of mission by speed of process. The final thing we always end these podcasts with is a question back to the guest. And we kind of ask, like, all right, if you're king for a day, you can make one change. What would that change be, and why would you do that?
I'm wondering if I should limit that to cybersecurity or just broad godlike.
You can take it however you want to go, Matt. It's your show.
So if I do have broad godlike powers, I think I'd probably offer two. One is, so I guess I will address my own pet peeve, and I will make it illegal for people to read slides during briefings or presentations. It drives me nuts. It happens all the time. It kind of speaks to, from my perspective, a lack of preparation. Most of us read pretty well. And so I would ban reading slides. on a more cybersecurity focused perspective, I'm going to adapt something I was told a long time ago when I was working at the NRO. NRO operates mission ground stations where they fly America's spy satellites. And the idea there that was communicated to me, and so Mike Nixon, if you're out there, this is thanks to you, you gave me this, was that everybody at headquarters should have to do 3 months at an operational location, right? Which is kind of this idea of, like, you're going to get steeped in what the real outcome is, the real culture, the real mission, the real product. Similarly, you know, when I was at Westinghouse, I never felt like I was closer to the real Westinghouse than when I was at a manufacturing location, talking to people on the floor who are machining, you know, fuel rod assemblies or something like that. So my other thing, if I'm going to take two, was that everybody involved in the headquarters elements or in the security elements would spend some time embedded in software development organizations, spend some time embedded in the programs, understand that the programs are not looking for shortcuts because they don't want to follow the rules. They're looking for shortcuts, they're looking for efficiencies because they know it takes longer than it should to do the right thing, and that we should be on board with that. So that's my other wish for cybersecurity types is to walk a mile in a software developer or a program manager or a resource manager or a mission owner's shoes and understand what it is we're really trying to do.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a great way to close out. So thanks so much, Matt. This is a wonderful conversation, right in line with what we try to do at All Quiet on the Second Front of nailing down kind of boring defense conversations, kind of break them apart. And it was really great to have another cybersecurity professional on talking about what we're doing every day to try to advance that software to the warfighter. So thanks so much for coming on board, and I hope to have you back another time.
Donnie, it was a privilege. I love talking with you. Thank you so much.